Welcome to A Skeptic's Guide to Conspiracy, a bi-weekly podcast dedicated to the examination of conspiracy theory, conspiracy fact, and those who promote these theories. I will be your host, Mike Bowler, as I examine a conspiracy theory, applying critical thinking and skepticism to better understand and seek out the truth behind conspiracy theories. So, for this episode, I'll be covering vaccines and vaccination conspiracies. For as long as humans have sat down and wrote histories, one of the most prevalent historical events of human history has been man versus disease. Throughout history, man's struggle against deadly infections have been fairly well documented and has been perhaps one of the longest struggles humans have had to deal with. Next to war, disease has changed, molded, affected human existence, perhaps as long as written history has been around. And with the humans' war against disease, it's been a fairly recent phenomenon to equate vaccinations with conspiracy. So for this episode, I'm going to cover some of the history of vaccinations and then the history of the conspiracies behind them. It is believed inoculations were developed in India or China before the 16th century. Scholar Ole Lund comments the earliest documented examples of vaccination are from India and China in the 17th century, where vaccination with powdered scabs from people infected with smallpox was used to protect against the disease. Smallpox used to be a common disease throughout the world, with 20 to 30% of affected persons dying from the disease. Smallpox was responsible for 8% to 20% of all the deaths in several European countries, and in the 18th century, the tradition of inoculation may have originated in India. In 1000 BCE, the mention of inoculation was noted by the French scholar Henri Marie Hudson Husson. The Anatolian Ottoman Turks knew about methods of inoculation. This kind of inoculations and other form of varicocelation was introduced to England by Lady Montagu, a famous English letter writer and wife of English ambassador in Istanbul between 1716 and 1718. She came across the Turkish methods of inoculation, consenting to have her son inoculated by the embassy surgeon Charles Maitland in the Turkish way. Lady Montagu wrote to her sister and friends in England describing the process in detail. On her return to England, she continued to propagate the Turkish tradition of inoculation and had many of her relatives inoculated. The breakthrough came when a scientific description of inoculation operation was submitted to the Royal Society in 1724 by Dr. Emmanuel Timothy. Montagu's family physician in Istanbul, inoculation was adopted both in England and France nearly a half century before Jenner's famous smallpox vaccine of 1796. Since then, the vaccination campaigns have spread throughout the globe, sometimes prescribed by law or regulations. Vaccines are now used against a wide variety of diseases like smallpox. Louis Pasteur further developed the technique during the 19th century, extending the use to killed agents protecting against anthrax and rabies. The method Pasteur used entailed treating the agents for those diseases so they lose their ability to infect, where the inoculation was hopeful selection of less virulent forms of the disease. And Jenner's vaccination entails the substitution of a different and less dangerous disease for those one protected against. Louis Pasteur adopted the name vaccine as a generic term in honor of Jenner's discovery. As Jenner began his work, inoculation was already a standard practice, but involved serious risks. Now, with the work up to this point, including Pasteur's discoveries along with the idea of pasteurization, pasteurization gave a twofold benefit. First, it made the milk and dairy products safer by rendering the bacteria and viruses that may have existed in the collection and processing of those products and had the added benefit of an extended shelf life. But oddly enough, in the United States, medical science had never reached the levels that the Europeans were attaining in research and the war against diseases. This would change as more Americans would find themselves learning from the various universities in Europe, mostly in France and Germany, and these doctors were bringing new techniques in research back to the United States. And it was decided roughly about the same time that Johns Hopkins University was going to establish a medical research hospital. And it would be Johns Hopkins that would lead the way in bacterial and viral infection research, making major discoveries roughly about the time of the great influenza pandemic of 1918-1919. Johns Hopkins scientists determined the source of the influenza to be a virus, where the virus came from and how it spread and how to deal with it. Unfortunately for the United States, two major events were going on. One was the U.S. involvement in the Great War, or as we call it today, the First World War. Second was the state of American doctors and the level of education they were receiving. This was that most doctors of the time tended to reject science and scientific discoveries that were coming out of Europe because their training did not allow them to think on those terms. Many of these doctors believed that treating the symptoms was more valuable than treating the cause, and this created debates between evidence-based medicine and science-based medicine factions within the medical community. In general, for a brief time, roughly about 50 years or so, science-based medicine won out. A vaccine was able to be developed against what was referred to as the Spanish flu, which was actually a swine flu, and the pandemic was brought under control. Unfortunately, areas that this disease spread to didn't have the benefits, plus again a war going on and a lot of censorship, so that there were needed to be those who needed to know weren't allowed to know. And with these early discoveries, how bacteria worked and viruses worked, various strategies were created to combat the effects. Drugs like penicillin and various vaccine types were being developed and began to show a lot of promise, coupled with the new standards in hygiene, clean water sources, and sewage disposal, reduced the effects of viral epidemics and pandemics. So the benefits of vaccinations were being proven every day. Research into antibiotics such as penicillin and the various derivatives of that were proving to be very effective in combating disease, but a couple of interesting events occurred in the late 20th century that began to create some problems. The big one was the swine flu outbreak in 1976. A vaccine was developed, and unfortunately a number of people came down with a neurological disorder known as Guillain-Barré syndrome. And interesting enough, it gave a few fringe doctors the opportunity to begin questioning vaccines. Now that there was always been an undercurrent of anti-vax doctors, mainly old-timers who had never really bought into the germ theory of disease. This is an important part of science behind viruses and bacteria causing disease, that it's clear that when dealing with infections such as flu, whether it be lung infection, a skin infection, and so on, are generally caused by some type of bacteria or virus or combination of both. So what are these conspiracies? Many of these conspiracies fall under one of these five. Vaccines don't work. Vaccines are dangerous. Vaccines contain dangerous toxins. The legal and ethical issues. And of course, Big Pharma. Now, most of these conspiracies do involve one or more of the above components. I think I will address each one individually. A fairly common anti-vax argument is that vaccines just don't work, usually citing anecdotal observations like people who get the seasonal vaccine and still get the flu. There is even some extremes where the claim is that the vaccines are just water and don't do anything and is just a ploy to empty our wallets. This is usually promoted by evidence-based practitioners. Evidence-based medicine is usually practiced by naturopaths, homeopathy practitioners, chiropractors, and acupuncturists. This concept is that the symptoms is the disease, so treating the symptoms cures the patient. And since vaccines are used to protect people from viruses that many of these evidence-based doctors don't believe exist, the idea that a vaccine doing anything is foreign to them. Now, there are risks involved with vaccines, as with any medical intervention. People with compromised immune systems are at risk taking a vaccine, and there are some conditions that can be caused by a vaccine. But in these cases, the conditions are well known and can be dealt with fairly easy by any competent doctor. Again, many of the evidence-based doctors try to point out these conditions, but fail to note that they are very rare situations. I have seen numbers as low as 1 in 1 million cases. But as a basic scare tactic, some of these reactions are pretty serious and should be dealt with quickly and should be dealt by a competent doctor. Guillain-Barré syndrome is an autoimmune syndrome that causes paralysis. It is known to be caused by viral infections themselves, but sometimes can be exacerbated by a vaccination. Guillain-Barré syndrome is where the immune system starts attacking nerve cells thinking they're viruses. And again, this could occur naturally during a virus infection or can be caused by a vaccination. This is what happened in 1976 swine flu epidemic. Fortunately, it was recognized real early what had happened and the vaccine was shut down. And to date, I've searched into the actual numbers involved and it appears that there were no deaths and a very small number who had actually contracted the syndrome. Now, the big favorite amongst anti-vaxxers is that vaccines are toxic or made from dangerous materials. Now, all vaccines are made from either live or dead virus and water. Other ingredients may have included thimerosal, aluminum, propylene glycol. Thimerosal is used as a preservative and contains methyl mercury. Many anti-vaxxers like to use this mercury as a cause for autism or a method for dumbing down children. Elementary mercury is very toxic and damaging to nerve and brain cells, but methyl mercury is a fairly benign form of mercury. And coupled with the fact that even under recommended vaccination schedules for those aged 6 months to 18 years, the amount of methyl mercury is less than the amount of elemental mercury found in a can of tuna. But interestingly enough, thimerosal has been removed from vaccines in the 90s and hasn't been present in children's vaccinations since then. Yet most anti-vaxxers have pressed forward that mercury has been causing autism. Propylene glycol, which is an antifreeze and has been used basically to prevent the water from freezing, damaging the dose, and possibly killing any live virus if it was a live vaccine. Again, these were very small amounts. Aluminum gels or salts of aluminum, which are added as adjuvants to help the vaccine stimulate a better response. Adjuvants help promote an earlier, more potent response and more persistent immune response to the vaccine. And again, anti-vaxxers like to cite aluminum as being a toxic substance, but the anti-vaxxers failed to mention that there is very little aluminum in vaccines and the body can easily deal with the amounts used. And what's interesting about all this, it seems to be a subculture where there is a belief that vaccines and the legal requirements to vaccine is a violation of civil rights. That is, can the state require someone to be vaccinated? There appears to be a number of lawyers now working on this issue, trying to make it sound like vaccinations are an invasion of privacy or the abrogation of individual rights to choice, and even in some cases seems to be a freedom of religion issue. And of course, there's Big Pharma. I'm not exactly sure what Big Pharma really is, but it sounds like, at least in the context of this topic, these are the various pharmaceutical companies that are using vaccines to make people sick so that they will use their drugs and increase their profits. So what is really going on with the anti-vax crowd? Many of the doctors who have promoted anti-vaccinations are usually heavily involved with alternative medicine, and you go to their websites and you'll find the various products they endorse, or in many cases they will sell to you outright on that website. Many of the lay people who have organized groups on the internet, and again, they will generally point to anti-vaccination doctors who will in turn try to sell you their products. And then you have doctors like Andrew Wakefield who created a study that was later refuted and retracted from publication. Again, one of the reasons was that Wakefield's attack on the MMR vaccination was an attempt to discredit MMR in favor of his own patented MMR vaccination. He failed to mention this in his paper as a conflict of interest. So, for conclusion, the 20th century advancements in science research has created various tools for doctors to deal with disease. Penicillin and other antibiotics deal with bacteria quite effectively, and when viruses were discovered and were understood how they operated, the development of vaccines again pressed forward a major leap in our war against disease. It's unfortunate that there are those who just can't accept these basic facts. I've tried to understand why there are still those who do not accept germ theory of disease. It is perhaps a continuation of the more unenlightened aspects of medicine, that there were still doctors operating in the 20th century that did not have the benefit of advanced research or the understanding of the scientific method. The state of medicine in the United States before the 20th century could be described as archaic and unenlightened. Most doctors of this period got no more than 6 weeks of classroom training and usually no practical training dealing with patients. And perhaps that's too bad considering the medical technology of the 19th century was probably not too scientific in the first place. Since treating compound fractures or various serious wounds involved amputation as opposed to surgeries or other interventions, it would take advancements in antibiotics, vaccinations, along with anesthetics that would expand the ability to treat serious disease and wounds, and coupled with improved sanitation procedures such as clean water and sewage treatment would greatly improve our health and longevity. It is a shame that there are those who are opposed to this for no other reason than profit.
I can no longer sit back and allow communist infiltration, communist indoctrination, communist subversion, and the international communist conspiracy to sap and impurify all of our precious bodily fluids.
For the big news this time around, I was a guest on the Cognitive Dissonance podcast. Tom and Cecil were great, and I really did enjoy myself. These guys have just way too much energy just keeping up with them. You know, eventually I found myself just going with the flow and cutting loose. So I probably sounded a lot different there than I do on my normal podcast. And what was kind of cool, I got a nice little boost of listenership, and that was pretty cool. And yeah, a little bit of feedback, and most of it was good. I really would like to see it better, but that's what feedback's for, so I can try to improve the show. But I did take exception to one review on iTunes. This is a review from Marcos, your best friend, who says, "I discovered this podcast while listening to one of my favorite podcasts, Cognitive Dissonance. I gave it a good, honest chance, but this podcast is garbage. The episode on 9/11 is an absolute joke. His speaking style is exhaustively boring, and he clearly cares nothing about facts. Waste of time." Unquote. Okay. Now, I'm going to be perfectly honest. I didn't really like the 9/11 show, so I'm going to probably end up doing a regular multi-part 9/11 breakdown, and I'm going to probably start that in either late January, early February. And I realize my speaking style when I do the stories are maybe a little bit too maybe a little dry, a little dull. That's just something I got to keep working on. But then again, history is one of these kind of, I think naturally it's a dull subject, but, so I think even any type of punching up may still come across as pretty, pretty boring. But I do take exception to the comment, he clearly cares nothing about facts. Now, I probably said this before in the earlier podcasts, and I'm going to say it again. This podcast is, I would like to think I fairly, did a fairly exhaustive job researching subjects. I've spent, hours upon hours going through both sides of the story and trying to understand the inner workings of these conspiracies, try to find facts, try to pull away the bullshit from the facts. And in some cases, like with one of my favorites, the Pearl Harbor conspiracies, I mean, I've spent almost 20 years researching these conspiracies. So me not caring about the facts is disingenuous. And quite frankly, I'm going to call this guy a chicken shit, mainly because he put this on iTunes, which of course I cannot rebut. I can't post a rebuttal to that comment. There are definitely, if you do have issues with any fact I present on this show, I have a email account, feedback@mikeboehler.com. That's MikeBoehler.com, which is, you can email me direct. You can find that, you know, my contacts on the website, MikeBoehler.com. I have got a section with the feedback email. I've got Google Plus, Facebook, my Twitter account. You name it, you can find me, and I'm more than happy to discuss, research, relook, whatever, anything you may find, at issue with the program. And I actually will challenge you if you really don't like what you've heard. Hey, that's what feedback's for. Let me have it. I will happily, answer your questions. If you make an honest effort, I'll make an honest effort. But I do thank everybody who did give me a good review that came from the Cognitive Dissonance podcast. I really do appreciate you listening, and hopefully you can enjoy this show. And another announcement, I'm going to say within the next, maybe within a week of you, receiving this show, I'll be a guest on, Carl Mamer's Conspiracy Skeptic podcast. I'll have links to that show. Be sure to check it out. Carl does an excellent job with, the various conspiracies that he's talked about. And, he's also has a few other, fun little side projects, I guess, or his various projects. Ask a Canadian. It's a hilarious show. You gotta listen to. So definitely, check that out. And maybe a final announcement. I'm kind of involved with this, group on, Google Plus, the Irreverent Skeptics, and we're preparing to launch another podcast, and I'm hoping to be involved with that. There'll be more on this, in January. I think that's when we're going to officially, launch the podcast version of it. So, stay tuned. I'll keep you informed on what's happening on that front. So, again, I'd like to thank everybody. Thank you for listening to this. And also, if you've listened to me on the BitSpot report, again, I got links on my website to get to that. Thank you very much. Thank you for listening to A Skeptic's Guide to Conspiracy. You can find my show notes and links to research material at mikebohler.com. That's MikeBohler.com. Feel free to leave me feedback at feedback@mikebohler.com. If there's a conspiracy you're interested in or wish to contribute more information to this or previous topics, feel free to send that to research@mikebohler.com. A Skeptic's Guide to Conspiracy is a proud member of the Dumbass Media Network. Be sure to check out other great podcasts at dumbassmedia.info. Intro music is Unchained Zarina from danosongs.com. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next time. Thank you. Good night.